So Judith Baker is a former Boston school teacher. She has for many years in the Boston school system, and she's now been involved in an incredible, interesting project called African Storybook, which is an attempt to work, to collaborate, in order to think about how e-literacy will make a difference in children and families' lives. So Judith, want to come up?
Thanks, Marge. When I first got involved in working with teachers in Africa, you would think it doesn't have anything to do with public health or disease particularly, but let me just tell you a couple of stories that sort of made the link. In about 2002, I was doing a two-day training, supposedly, for all the education professional development officials in the South African Teachers Union in KwaZulu-Natal, and KwaZulu-Natal is really the epicenter of the AIDS epidemic. If there is one, it's there, where you're seeing 40 and 45 and 47% antenatal infection rates even now. And so I just happened to have, it was just a coincidence, I had a picture, an electron micrograph of the AIDS virus that my husband had given me. And it was sitting on my notebook. And one of the union officials looked at it and he said, and it's a very ugly, I'm sure you've all seen this stuff, it's a really ugly creature. And he looked at it and he said, "What is that?" And I said, "Oh, that's the AIDS virus." And he snatched it, he took it, and I didn't want to lose it because it was the only one I had. And in 2 days, that picture went to every single person. There were 187 people there. Went to every single person. People were staring at it, talking about it, looking at it, and saying, "You see, it's real. It's real. If you can take a picture of it, it's real." And you've got to understand that literacy isn't... it's hard to go from one language and culture to another language and culture. You can't just translate something from a language to another language. And AIDS education was like that. It was written in English and then it was just translated into isiZulu and Xhosa, all these other languages. And when it was translated, it was just sort of word for word translated without taking into account what local people knew about disease. And so, for example, I was in a school that I worked in a lot, and the principal said, "Take these kids and talk to them about HIV." And he put 150 kids in this room. Now, the only ones who knew English were very few, and they sat in the front. Everybody else did. They knew, couldn't understand me at all. But if I said, "What's HIV?" they could recite in English what it was. And if I said, "What do you do about it?" they could recite in English what it was. They had rote learned every possible answer. They knew everything there was to know in English about HIV. But it didn't change their behavior, not at all, because rote learning doesn't change your behavior, and translation doesn't change your behavior. But that time I was there, I'd gone to the Fenway Clinic, and they'd given me 10,000 condoms to bring to the school. And they were black skin color condoms instead of the usual condoms. It was the only time I ever had black skin color condoms to take to people. I mean, they were like overjoyed. The kids wanted them, and they were really mad at me because I only gave them to the teachers because I wasn't allowed to give them to the kids. The teachers would take 200-300. You know, you couldn't give them 5. You had to give them, a reasonable amount for human being. And the kids came to me after, the same kids who, wrote, learned this and forget it, meant nothing. "Well, why can't we have them? We're the ones that need them." So when things actually are presented in a way that accords with something that people really believe already and already have some at least attachment to, then you see a completely different result. And so over the last 15 years, I know you all aren't linguists, but linguistics has changed enormously in what it's trying to, what people are beginning to see causes literacy. And now we really are beginning to talk about multilingual development. That is, drawing very, very, very heavily on familiar language for early literacy. Becoming strongly attached to text in familiar language. The sounds, the culture, the concepts, the images of one's familiar language, even though there are 3,000 languages in Africa, 1,500 of them written down, and this is a big challenge. And so you're beginning to see a real change in what literacy is about. Now, how do I change the slide? Just down and up? Okay. So the African Storybook Project is one of the most exciting things. I think you're gonna see how exciting this is. This is not an American USAID project. This is an African project seated in Johannesburg in Nairobi, which sees a lot of agreed upon needs in Africa, and I think that you'll find the same situation in Honduras or Indonesia or whatever, but this is Africa and it's all I know. You're looking to figure out why there are low literacy rates, because there's an effective literacy rate in Africa of 20%. You can say that countries report 86% and 72% and everything else, it's just completely false. But on the other hand, there are people who desperately want to preserve local language and local cultures. You have literacy organizations which are doing very well. You have no appropriate early reading materials in any but the 20 largest languages in Africa. The rest of them have nothing, not one book, not one single thing for the child to read other than a Bible or government documents. Writers, therefore, can't make a living in local languages. Publishers can't make a living. Illustrators can't make a living. Therefore, 90% of all publishing in Africa is government documents. Very, very little in bookstores. And so if you only read one thing, if you don't listen to me, just read this one article. Suzanne Romaine, just this year, has collected all of the statistics about the Millennium Development Goals. And what she posits is, and I don't have a photograph here, I don't have a diagram to show you, but that language is in the middle. And every single one of the Millennium Development Goals relies on language knowledge. Now, I'm not talking about oral language knowledge. I'm talking about text language knowledge. For example, the Millennium Development Goal of Universal Free Primary Education and the Millennium Development Goal of combating HIV, AIDS, malaria, and other diseases are totally, completely linked, more so than we ever realized before. And just one figure from her, paper, 90% of people in Africa have no knowledge, oral or written, of the official language of their country in which everything is written, in the language which is used for communication. Now, of that 90%, most of those people are located in the most language-diverse countries in Africa, which means Sudan, South Sudan, Chad, Congo, Cameroon, and Central Africa. That is, that they don't have any knowledge. There's no use trying to think that the materials you're producing. Now, these same 90% are your most vulnerable people. And so if you have a figure, some figure of 70% literacy, but 97% of women in northern Nigeria do not have, so your marginalized populations are 100% to 90% illiterate. So the most vulnerable populations, the ones who are the vectors, the victims, and so on, it's not like a graph where some have this and some have this. None or some is really the way to look at language. That is, no literacy in the areas where the incidence is the highest, however you want to talk about the causality. And the way that this works out, and the reason for the African Storybook, is that there are no books in the 1,500 languages that most people speak in Africa. 90% of the people in Africa speak. Since there are no books, no matter how much you aspire to reading, there's nothing to read. The only thing there is to read in some areas are donated books in Norwegian, Swedish, Chinese, English, French, Portuguese, and so on. encyclopedias dating from 1953 that somebody donated because they thought, I'd hate to throw this out, and so on. Or government materials that have been translated, and if you try to read them in the other languages, you know, they're translations, but they're not authentic versions, and they have very few pictures, if any, to guide you. So because people have nothing to read, they don't read, so they have no demand for books, and the publishers can't sell them, and so what you have is a market failure of great proportions. But once you see that it's a market failure, see, market failures can be adjusted, market failures can be corrected once you realize there's a market failure, and so what the African Storybook is aiming at doing is correcting this market failure. And it's doing it by open source because children don't need 5 books to learn to read. The current literary theory is you need 6 years and probably 1,000 or 2,000 books, individual books, so that you're reading a new book all the time, so that you're not memorizing the book, you're learning how to take a book unexpected, not knowing what's in it, and find your way through it, even if there are only 3 or 4 words on a page in the early reading. And so our goal is to move from absolute scarcity to tremendous abundance, thousands or tens of thousands of books that will, in fact, change the market and make a market that then others can actually make a living in. And the other thing is we have to create an access to those books because it doesn't do any good to produce them. They have to have access. So we believe that young children have to attach to reading and mother tongue. The research all over the world shows this. Children who are not taught to read in mother tongue do not become literate in any language, except for the geniuses who, you know, are probably sitting in this room, because you all just are so persistent that you know, and fortunate. But most people don't learn to read other than in their own language first. And when you do learn to read in your mother tongue and you become proficient at text, it becomes very easy to transfer and read in other languages. So the recent studies in South Africa are that children who are taught mother tongue up to for 4 or 5 years, either starting at age 3 in preschool or age, you know, 6 in school, are much better at English than children who are taught in English immersion from the beginning. English scores are significantly higher for those who have been taught in their mother tongue first. Very, very interesting. And so, we have a project. So the project started out in KwaZulu-Natal with some teachers who were working with me, and we would take books that we could get, and we would version them into isiZulu. And we would work with high school kids, write the story over again in Zulu so that it made sense within the Zulu culture. And then on Saturdays, the teachers go to the village and they just read the stories with children. Now, I've sat in classrooms in where the teacher sits and she's told she has to read to kids. So she takes the book and she reads, she stands like this, and she reads the book to the children in English, or you could do it. And African children are wonderful. They will smile, they'll laugh, they'll do whatever they think they're supposed to do, but they don't, haven't understood one word of that story. You would never know that they don't understand it because they're very good at appropriate behavior. But if you read the story to them in their language, they jump up and down and dance and act it out and tell it, and what you have is actual reading and actual comprehension rather than nice behavior. So in this program, these children are illiterate children. They're not in school yet for the most part. They come on Saturday on their own because they love to come. They get the books read to them. Then they sit down and they write their own books. Now these children are going to be, they're going to make it. They're going to make it. Just from this little Saturday reading class. And usually the high school kids come and read to them, but this particular day was an exam day, so they couldn't come. And here's the master teacher. Again, the animation, the participation when children are reading in their own language is a totally different experience than some sort of English immersion first grade classroom. Now, we also figure out that people can write in mother tongue. And these are community librarians. These people are in Uganda. They have little community libraries, which means they might have a box of books in their house that people come on Saturday and read, or they might have a little building, or they might have a community center. They've never written books before in their lives. And we spent a whole day writing books, performing them, And at the end of the day, we had about 20 lovely books, not quite publishable, but if we'd had the time, at least a half dozen of them would have been perfectly publishable in mother tongue. Nothing to do with a foreign culture. The images were appropriate, the language is appropriate, the activities are appropriate. And then they're acting out their books, and they're having a wonderful time. These are children's books, but adults love children's books, and they can read from... I mean, if I were learning Vietnamese, I think I would definitely start with children's books. I wouldn't start with an adult book, right? Because I need the pictures. Now, these are parents in Uganda, in this little tiny village. None of them are literate. They all have young children. And they all feel, after this, we did a long workshop on brain science and how the brain learns to read and how it's important to do a lot of practice. And these mothers said, oh, well, if the brain needs a lot of practice, then that means I have to give my children a lot of practice. So I can do that. I can't read, but I can certainly point at pictures. And these women, I mean, they come in every Saturday to this person's house, and they are illiterate, but that doesn't mean that they're uninterested, that they don't want literacy, or that they can't figure out what to do. And, of course, by participating, they're picking up some things, but they wouldn't pick up anything if it was in English. There wouldn't be no bridge. There's no way. So I think I don't know their mother tongue. I can't tell you what language they're working in. Now, some of these women are Muslim women who are very, very restricted in their movements. And it's a real problem that their husbands really don't like this sort of thing. But once they got started, you couldn't stop them. You know, once they just made the break with that kind of restriction, then that's it. Then they go. Now, we have a sponsor. Luckily, we had a concept, and now we have a sponsor who is Comic Relief in the UK, which is a wonderful sponsor. And so we now have a project which has just started in May. And this is what we are. We're creating an e-library of African children's picture storybooks. With illustrations that you can very easily version into a local language. If you can read the book in a language that it is on the web, you then sign in and text box pops up and you can just write it into local language and you have a local language just like that. So we believe that people all over Africa can do this. Teachers, literate parents, churches, community organizations, literacy, NGOs, devoted community members, and we're finding all over the place that people, in fact, can do this. And we're piloting for 4 years. We have 4 years of piloting money, and we're working in the most remote places in Uganda, Kenya, Lesotho, and South Africa, as well as a couple of urban, peri-urban areas. Everything is open source, but everyone gets credit for everything they do. The authors and illustrators retain copyright, so they can always take the stuff down if they want to, but they know that other people can use it and version it and so on. And you can transmit these on unsmart cell phones, as well as cell phones that are smartphones, tablets, anything you want. If you do have nothing whatsoever, you can print them out at a print shop. You can put them on a CD. You can project them. We have little tiny palm projectors. You stick your flash drive with 100 stories in it. You project them on the wall of a mud school. You don't need electricity. It's just battery. And you can read a new story every week. You can version it first into local language. And then we're hoping that people who version them into local language will upload that local language version back so other people can use it. So that's our concept. And we think it's a huge breakthrough. And we have been presenting this all over Africa, and everyone else thinks it's a huge breakthrough. So literacy organizations all over the place are beginning to join us. And I don't know, my time is probably up, but I do want to tell you a couple little stories. Anyway, this is where we expect to get books, but who knows, you might want to write one too. And we need illustrators desperately. That's one of our real problems, is trying to make sure we can get everything illustrated. So we get a little story, then we try to transform it into a little book. Hopefully you'll be able to print out the book so you can fold it up and then cut the things and you have the book as a book form rather than even having to staple it, but who knows, we'll get there. And we're also trying to make the image library such that you can substitute a mother without a headscarf for the woman with a headscarf, for the hut that's made out of wood, for the hut that's made out of stone or whatever. That's like down the road, but we're trying. And we're trying to build a network, a community of people in Africa and the African diaspora who want, because in the African diaspora are parents all over the world who want to read to their children in their own language, and there's nothing for them to read either. So we have a lot of potential partners. We have a lot of pilots that we're in the process of setting up. And then we have a research network of 10 African universities who are going to be having PhD and master students doing their theses, studying aspects of the project to see what does and doesn't work. We figure if we fail, somebody else will do it. So we won't fail completely because the idea is too powerful, and hopefully we will succeed, but we think once we've got the idea out of the bag, it's out of the bag, and we really do think it's going someplace. We have lots of problems with intellectual property challenges, and we have to worry about intellectual property in the same way as AIDS drugs have to worry about intellectual property. But we also feel, in the same way as AIDS drugs, you have market inefficiencies that are the reason why you have to do it this way, and you don't have a choice. No one is going to produce books in Luganda. Nobody's going to produce books in most of the languages of Africa. They just can't afford to. And so that's this. Now, let me just tell you a couple of little stories. Do I have time to or no? Am I out? No. Okay, I won't then. I won't.
One story.
I'll tell you a sad story. I hope. But sad because maybe it helps us understand. The leading AIDS educator from the union, because I worked a lot with the union in because I work with teachers. So we had a wonderful union leader. Oh, my God, this guy was just brilliant, and he was a wonderful organizer, very humane, very, very, very good dealing with people. And so he was the leading AIDS education person who would go around to teachers and teach them about AIDS education. And unfortunately, people at that point, this is 2004, didn't really understand the problems with versioning and translation and this and that. So he had a set curriculum, and he'd go around and he'd teach all the teachers. Of course, we found out that he himself had AIDS, and he died of AIDS. He refused to take medicines. He didn't do any of the things that he was training the teachers to do. And we were just mortified, horrified, furious, upset. We just couldn't cope with this, losing him, because he was so powerful. We thought, well, if he knows all of this, why? Why did this happen? But now, you know, over the years, I'm beginning to see, we never made the cultural shift. We never understood the power of familiar language and familiar culture, and why you have to think about language policy when you think about health. There's no way to separate health out from people's what they know, what they believe, what they practice. He could not face the stigma of telling people, even people who knew, even his girlfriend and his family. They knew he was dying of AIDS. He couldn't say it. He didn't have a language for it because there was nothing in isiZulu, because they had never created the isiZulu version of AIDS education. They were using a European version, and I think we can all learn from that now. And now with digital, we have an opportunity. Thank you very much.